We'll text later.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio here with Kirk this evening. And Kirk, I want to just have a quick moment on COVID-19.
Sure.
I've been outspoken saying that I thought that the consequence of the deprivation of livelihoods and liberty was going to be much greater than the disease itself, and I stand behind that. I think that is true.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that wearing masks, it's a Torah advised. The Torah specifically tells us to wear masks under these circumstances. And isolating people that have the virus is also something that Yahweh prescribed, in addition to copious amounts of washing, keeping your hands sterile and clean. All Torah advice, all good advice, would make a tremendous difference. We live in a time mm-hmm. where there are lots of negatives and lots of positives. You know, for example, I say it's the best time in the world to be translating and studying the Torah because we have so many wonderful tools. We not only have access to the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic, you can compare the two, but we have marvelous Hebrew-English dictionaries to study the etymological roots of words, and we can study it from the perspective that science and history have provided. And then we can communicate it using the internet. It's a marvelous time. As it relates to COVID, there is a plus, and that is that science has come up with an entirely different way to make a vaccine. It's called a messenger RNA vaccine. And these vaccines, when they first were announced, I was skeptical of them. I said, I don't want my DNA messed with, and said, I'm concerned with this approach. And the next show I came back and said my concerns were probably unjustified. There is no modification to your actual DNA. It's a messenger from your RNA telling your body to produce the antibodies for the virus. As it's turned out, now that there have been many, many tens of millions of people, probably close to 100 million people have been vaccinated around the world, the vaccines are outperforming all of the trials, the exceedingly few consequences and exceedingly good results. And so I just want to encourage everyone, ignore all of the conspiracy anti-vax nonsense. The most recent is that a fellow, they present him as the former head of research at Pfizer, is now anti-vaccine. And, of course, that is exceedingly misleading. There was a fellow who 11 years ago was head of a small unit of research for Pfizer, and his research happened to be in allergies, and Pfizer fired him. They fired his whole unit because they didn't have any confidence in the efficacy of what he was doing. And he subsequently went on his own, raised a bunch of money, and took the research that he had been paid to conduct for Pfizer, which is criminal, by the way, got companies like Amgen to invest several hundred million dollars in the research. And when Amgen and others took it to first phase clinical trials, the efficacy was nil. And this fellow's business was just wiped away. Amgen took a $450 million write-down. Well, this guy has obviously is disgruntled that he was let go of Pfizer a decade ago, and that his research turned to nothing. It was research had nothing to do with COVID or viruses. It was on eczema, the skin rash. And bitter. He went from, you know, vaccines are the hope of the world to claiming that pregnant women will have miscarriages, and there's just no evidence of it. And one of the big problems with vaccines is they're exceedingly easy for conspiracies to tout the negative. Because, for example, with the one of the vaccines, there have been five people who have died after getting the vaccine from blood clots. They say, oh, my God, that's just terrible. It's giving people blood clots and they're dying. No, no. If you took a random sample of 25 million people, which is the number of people that have this vaccine, and you realize that five people have died of blood clots, that's about the number of people you would expect to die of blood clots out of 25 million people. People die, you know, and just because
every day,
that this is the problem of it is it's, you're always going to have people dying who've had a vaccine because guess what? People die. And if you give tens of millions of vaccines, then you're going to have a reasonable number of people die. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the vaccine. So please don't pay any attention to the conspiracies. Do the right thing. Be safe.
Yes.
I was translating something this morning. Kirk, I told you it was I started at 3 o'clock your time, 6 o'clock my time. And before we get back to where we were in the story of the garden and the exodus from the garden, I want to share what I translated and wrote this morning because I think it's exceedingly poignant for God's people. I doubt that what I'm going to share with you has even been considered by anyone in the last 3,000 years. And yet, it is exceedingly poignant for Israel and for God's people. Now it came to pass, after many days, when Moshe, the one who draws out, had become great, had been reared and become exalted within his community, that he went out to his brethren. And he observed the burden of their forced labor. Then he witnessed a Mitzri. Mitzri is the symbol of Mitzrayim. It is an oppressive religious or political person, in this case an Egyptian. Striking and beating, nakah, afflicting and destroying, wounding to the point of death by way of repeated blows. An Ibri, a Hebrew man. One of his brothers. My commentary on Shemoth Dames 2:11 is that there is a time to kill. There are circumstances in which the most merciful thing to do is to take the life of another. The Egyptian taskmaster was an implement of a diabolical and deadly political and religious regime. Without cause, he was beating an innocent man to death. There is little doubt that he had done the same thing yesterday and would do it again tomorrow if given the chance. This solitary event serves, however, as a microcosm for the conquest of the Promised Land. Those who had become naturally cruel and abusive, even deadly, would have to be removed for God's people to live. That said, unless we are in the exact same situation, witnessing a brutal individual in the throes of beating a helpless and innocent family member to death, we ought not respond in kind. Violence breeds more of the same. Words wielded wisely are almost always more effective than fists, bullets, or bombs. In this specific case, in his righteous indignation, albeit cautiously, Moshe turned this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck and killed the Mitzri. Then he concealed, he buried, hiding him from the light, him in the sand, within that which is insignificant, common, and ordinary. Let's be clear. Moshe was right only because there was no other option. Words would not have mattered. Cruel beatings would have continued. The Egyptians were absolutely and unequivocally wrong. And even then, Moshe suffered the consequence of standing up against a misguided culture. So when he went out the next day, he beheld two Hebrews who were quarreling and who were fighting, afflicting and destroying one another, wounding each other to the point of death by way of repeated blows. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why are you choosing to make physical contact with, to strike and afflict your fellow countrymen?" He answered, "Who set you in charge? Who made you a judge over us?" Listen to that. He said, "Who set you in charge? And who made you a judge over us? Will you kill me just as it is said that you killed the Mitzri?" As a result, Moshe was concerned. And he said to himself, "Indeed, this statement is known and it is accepted." We can move on, believing the myth that all is well that ends well. Or alternatively, we can deal with the realization that this Hebrew's response to someone trying to protect and save him, even encourage him to think about what he was doing to harm his brother, has become a character flaw throughout the generations. Substitute Yahweh for Moshe and Yisrael for the man who, after afflicting his kin, rebuked the one trying to help him. And we can appreciate what God has endured from his people. Yahweh has personally engaged to protect Israel, to free his people, and to save them from those who would harm them. Then after demonstrating his concern and compassion, after standing up for them, they have dismissed him. He has asked those inflicting the deadliest religious and cultural blows upon their own brethren to think about what they're doing throughout the Torah and prophets. And yet, they're not listening. Instead, they have rejected Yahweh, his name, his authority, his word, his concern, his mercy, and his offer to save them. They have put themselves in charge with rabbis acting as judges, as the ones who decide the fate of Jews. So under these circumstances, especially among the religious, the question lingers. Will Yahweh walk away and allow them to die at their own hand and through the blows of others? Do you, Yada? Yahweh answered this question. Moshe walked away. He allowed his people to reject his compassion, his concern, and his willingness to protect them, even his attempt to get them to assess their situation and respond differently. He would leave them to suffer under the Mitzray, the oppressors, for another 40 years, the designated time of testing. It was only then, and only after all Yisrael pleaded with God to save them, that Yahweh's pleading, Moshe would return to save them. Yahweh providing them with answers, and he led them to the promised land. But that's not the end of the story. Yahweh will make one final attempt to reconcile his relationship with his people, doing so on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, sunset in Jerusalem, on October 2nd, 2033. In advance of his return, he is still encouraging his people to think, providing them with all of the answers so that they would yada Yahweh. As a listener, your natural inclination may be to move on, to listen to what comes next, without pausing long enough to let what Yahweh revealed resonate within your heart, mind, and soul. But please, it has been 3,500 years since God shared this with us, hoping that we would ultimately come to terms with who he is, what he is offering, and what we have done to sweep it all aside. He has waited long enough, and he deserves better.
Wow.
That is how I spent my morning.
Well, that's a pretty good way to spend your morning. I had never thought about the Moshe being like God, and he warned him, and then he walks away, and then he comes back and saves him later, which is the history.
Or would you have thought that it's the response of his fellow Israelites
that
represents the very response that Israel has given over these 3,000 years? Who are you, God, to tell us what to do? What, you're going to be judge over us?
Yeah, well, they chose Shaul, didn't they? They don't want David.
Yeah, and they...
That would be like a goy.
And Yahweh walked away. He'll come back, but he walked away. It is it's the most telling story. It is the story of all stories that Jews need to hear.
Well, you know, it also, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Well, I was just thinking, you know, we've been paralleling Mitzrayim with and the Moshe story of returning and taking them out, and where there's the calm before the storm when they're sitting there never thinking the day's going to be any different. And this is what, just like everybody else today is thinking as well, tomorrow will be like today, and all of a sudden the world's just collapsing. I mean, and then we throw in some wars and some horrible things that could happen with asteroids, et cetera, and storms, irrelevant.
Yeah.
I mean,
the world,
to all
the world is
parts,
actually,
I mean,
collapsed.
Places. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's collapsed already. The value of the currency, the economy, individual freedom, a willingness to discuss and accept the truth, the prevalence of conspiratorial, political, and religious lies, the world's collapsed. It is over. We just, and a lot of people know it now. I mean, there is a lot of realization that there will never be a return to what existed a year ago. Well, a year ago, things were bad.
Yeah,
and they are essentially infinitely worse, and they will never go back to what they were. Where we were, speaking of where we were, Barbara Streisand sings the song, Barashim 4:1. Was it the way we were? Yeah, one of my favorites.
Close enough.
Yeah, such an amazing situation where she is politically among the most misguided women in the world. And yet the voice is is so piercing and powerful. So there's the nature of man.
Great. And voice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, the man, Adam, became aware of Chawa. She became pregnant and conceived, giving birth to Cain. Cain means to create and to bring forth, as well as to acquire and possess. Q-Y-N, Cain. It's Q-A-Y-N, the way it's phonetically pronounced, but the letters are Q-Y-N. And she said, I have created and brought forth, Kana, I have conceived and acquired, and I possess a man to be against Yahweh. Then in addition, she gave birth to his brother, Hebel, H-B-L, written H-E-B-E-L. I don't know how we got Abel out of that, but it's Hey Beth Lamed, Hebel. You know what Hebel's name means?
Well, I found it, and I found it.
A waste of breath.
It, because you don't find it easily, but it's it is.
No.
It's right there.
a waste of breath.
Waste of breath.
Yeah, vapor, which is fleeting and unfulfilling, commonly known as Abel, from Hebel, to be a waste and to be in vain.
Emptiness, futile.
Well, those are two really sweet names. You know, why don't we call our children Shaul and Satan? Can I have a Beelzebub, please? Maybe a Baal.
Yeah.
You know, and if we have another, why not name of Hadrian and Hitler? I mean, come on, woman. Oh, somebody
well,
has
some
resentment
issues. They tell the story. They tell the story.
I'm
surprised.
Good grief, we have some resentment issues.
Well, no joke.
You
said that a long time ago about when you were doing this originally, you said, you know, that she's not quite with the team here.
No, she's just
terrible.
Not playing on the same team as God.
But after I dug into it, I'm saying, my God, this woman is, she hates Yahweh.
She does.
She really can't stand him. I mean, it's obvious she can't stand him.
Yeah, yeah. When she decided to be like God, it wasn't because she liked God.
Mm.
No, she wanted to be above God. She wanted the same thing Satan. Anyway, so those are the two names. We can live with them, masticate them, contemplate them. I can tell you that the religious did a very poor job of transliterating Chawa, Cain, and Abel. Because Cain is Q-Y-N, not C-A-I-N.
No C.
Goodness. And Hebel, H-B-L. Of course, Chawa, they changed Eve. It's amazing how off they can be. And that's disappointing because I think the insights, while disappointing, are worth considering. It is telling that Chawa was given naming rights when that had been Adam's job. Remember when Yahweh says he started to engage with Adam? And one of the very first things he said is he gave Adam naming rights. So here's the person who had naming rights when he was God, with God, and all of a sudden now it's Chawa who is responsible for the names. I don't know if Adam chose platypus or not, or aardvark, but I can tell you that platypus and aardvark are a whole lot better than waste of breath. Against God. I will say, though, that I did watch a short documentary on what Australia is doing to protect the platypus. And I'll tell you, a young baby platypus is a darn cute little thing. I think I owe God an apology. It is really
they are adorable.
Cute. They are absolutely adorable. And their whole way of interacting and everything, I was wrong. The platypus is a remarkably wonderful design. Had given Adam naming rights, and of course he now had lost that to his wife. And since it was Adam, not Yahweh, who fathered Cain, we cannot translate Eth as with, accompanied by, or associated with Yahweh. And that leaves us contemplating opposing options. Did she mm-hmm. say that this child was to be against or to be in accord with Yahweh? Since we're told that Cain was not in agreement with Yahweh, it becomes obvious that Yahweh was harboring a grudge.
Mm-hmm.
While it is an extreme interpretation of animosity, Cain's name implies it is possible that it was Yahweh who may have encouraged Cain, whom she claimed to possess, to oppose Yahweh's instructions by killing his brother. What else are we to make of her saying, I have acquired and I possess the means to oppose Yahweh? Further, she named a son whose relationship with Yahweh held promise, Hebel. She named him a waste of breath. It is little wonder she had no compunction against misstating Yahweh's instructions. It actually hurts me to bring this news. It's not what I thought, not what I expected. It's just that we made a commitment. We're going to go where the words lead. We know that Yahweh had been Plan C. Plan A was for Yahweh to spend ever more time with Adam. Plan B was to introduce Adam to the behemoth, all of the animals that existed in and outside of the garden, to find a companion for him. And Plan C had been Yahweh. She was clearly tricked by the serpent. She had deceived Adam. She failed to accept responsibility. And now, bound to this man emotionally and physically, she was holding a grudge. After having been cast out of the garden, Adam may still have been blaming her for his mistake in judgment too. Adding to her frustration, she experienced the travail of childbirth. It had been too much for her to handle. And can you imagine these two? You know, they're frolicking mm-hmm. in the garden. They have a personal relationship with the creator of the universe. That's, the environment is absolutely perfect, probably almost as nice as it is here in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And all of a sudden, they're out there in the wild. They're having to work. They're it's painful. It's it's just life became difficult. Imagine what stress it must have been on their relationship. Yahweh did not handle it well.
No.
And if I may offer another perspective, Yahweh, out of the garden, may represent wayward Yisrael. She was confused, and she was lashing out at God. Keep in mind, neither Adam nor Yahweh were conceived to be bad. They were both good. But all that changed when they sought to experience bad. This is the likely result. It is why Yahweh warned them that they would come to embody that which they chose to consume. Corrupting Yahweh's instructions and then disregarding them had led to this very place. Hebel, a waste of breath, one who lacks value, who is meaningless and futile, continually existed as a shepherd. As a shepherd of sheep, and existed for a time to work the ground, the Adamah. Hebel was engaged in Yahweh's favorite vocation. He was shepherding sheep. Moreover, in the imperfect conjugation, caring for, feeding, protecting, and leading his flock was something that he did consistently with unfolding implications over time. He was symbolic of the likes of Moshe and Dode, Yahweh's shepherds. By contrast, Cain, who outlived his brother, was not as diligent or as consistent in his work, tilling the land. Abad was truncated with the perfect conjugation. Did you check up on the boys' names?
I did, and but I'll tell you something. It was even more interesting. All of the things that you say is true. Hebel, of course, is from Habel, or whatever, and the it means obviously breath and vapor and emptiness, futile, delusion, vain, worthless, fraud. I mean, these are terrible things to call your son. Useless.
Yep.
But it was interesting. What I also found is when she said, I looked at possess, when she says, I possessed Cain.
Yeah, right.
And Gana is the verb used to get, acquire, mm-hmm. possess, bought, or buy.
Mm-hmm.
In ancient times, of course, we know that you measure your wealth by possessions. So that's a thing to her. You know, she's got him as opposed to Yahweh. At least
yeah.
that's the way I would read it. I would say that's significant. And then I looked at the noun, because that's a verb, so I looked at the noun that it reinforces, and that's Kina, Q-I-N-A-H in English, means jealousy, envy, rivalry, anger, and a protective, suspicious nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference between that is you have exactly the same word, but you add a aleph between the nun and the woman standing, which I thought was really interesting letter form, you know. Everything, I wasn't trying to look to say, well, because it doesn't look, unless you dig around a little bit, those things that you're saying don't immediately pop up on all the basic lexicons.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you dig through and go to the next letter and you go to the verb, all the things that you've taught us to do that we've been following suit, use the verb as a verbal root to the noun and so forth, and go
yes.
through the letters that associate. And a lot of times you'll find they give different numbers to the same word. You have to look at all those words, all those meanings to do it. And you paint a picture. This woman hates him. He hates Yahweh. She possesses these boys. She owns them. She, or at least his older son. And yeah, and probably Hebel wasn't too excited about Mom, and she probably encouraged him to knock him off. I can't prove that, but it's, she certainly didn't. I don't think she lost any, shed any tears.
No, certainly Hebel had a good relationship with Yahweh, and I'm fairly certain, based upon what we're reading here,
mm-hmm.
that Yahweh resented that.
Yes, she's lost two guys now to Yahweh. Her
yes.
husband and her second son. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
It's a really a sad situation.
But beyond what in Cain, here's, I'll tell you what I did find on this. This is my commentary. Logically speaking, I looked at Cain and I said, okay, he's had no fatherly supervision. He ignores all of Yahweh's advice.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously hates his brother.
Yep.
We're not told anything important regarding his relationship with his mother in a lot of clearly, but one could conclude that.
But he had mommy issues,
boys
that's for sure.
Well, that's what I wrote next. I'd say one could conclude that most all boys, if you ever read Freud, bond with their mothers, and Yahweh mm-hmm. did not seem to, and we know she didn't revere Yahweh. So that's got
mm-hmm.
to be. So then I said, I'll wager that you're absolutely right when you used against. So
yeah, now, I can share that this is a personal observation, because a lot of times we learn from our own experience. But you know, my ex had borderline personality disorder, which is, if I say it simplistically, it's primarily women that have this disorder. It's not treatable. And it's very similar to narcissism, and it creates this sense of victimization. So a person that has this feels like they're constantly being victimized. They have delusions that they actually believe are true, that there's almost no correlation between reality and what goes on in their mind and what they claim and say. And then they project the most derogatory possible notions on everyone around them. So when I'm reading these words about Chawa, I'm seeing this horrible psychosis that my ex suffered from, and it's not curable. So this is not something you'd feel sympathy for, and what we need to help, not curable. A borderline personality disorder, and that certainly seems to be what she was suffering from. But as it relates to Cain, the firstborn son is usually imprinted by the mother, if the mother has that kind of psychosis. And so Cain may have been imprinted by his mother's psychosis. My eldest son, he ultimately succumbed to it, and so it is not terribly uncommon for this to occur. And of course, it's called borderline personality disorder. It's what I'm seeing in this, and I'm seeing mother and son both suffering from it. Yeah. It came to exist that Cain came and brought from the fruit of the soil a portion to approach Yahweh. And Hebel also came and he brought his firstborn of his flock in addition to those who were the fittest and finest. So Yahweh was attentive to and accepted Hebel and his offering. But towards Cain, and with regard to his offering, he regarded it unfavorably. Then Cain kindled animosity and became overtly enraged. His face was downcast. It's quite a picture. So, you know, God, when he chose Dode, even when his father, said, you know, These are all my best sons. I don't even know why you want to go get that other kid down there. And, you know, he's certainly not the one that's going to impress you. And God made it very clear. He says, you know, what impresses me about people is very different than what impresses man. And here we have a man who's named Waste of Breath, and yet he impressed God. And we have a man named I Possess, I Control, I Contend, and he did not. So man's view of what is important among men and God's view of man are very, very different. Now, of course, there's some, you know, symbolism here, of course, that Yahweh has a preference for shepherds and that he views himself as a shepherd with his flock, and he views Moshe and Dode as the ultimate shepherds who are leading and nurturing his flock. And of course, it's the Passover lamb who would serve as the means to open the doorway to life. And so there was an enormous amount of symbolism there, and being the first fruits is speaks of the third of the seven Moed Mikra. To prioritize what we celebrate with Yah is important. Yahweh loves his feasts where he's inviting us to attend. And all of that symbolism was captured by Hebel. And of course, with Cain, he was hit and miss on his work. Didn't really care much for it. The perfect conjugation versus the imperfect. And he just brought whatever was handy. Let me grab some of this, you know, from off of the side of the field. So they had an entirely different perspective on Yahweh, an entirely different relationship with Yahweh. It has so much more than one was a farmer and the other was a shepherd. Any thoughts on this, Kirk, before we move on?
Well, no, it's pretty. No, I think you've nailed it on the got it nailed on the head there. When you get down to, I do want a little shout out. When you get down to Nepal, I want to tell you what that's discovered.
Okay.
But as we move all along, right. But no, they are very much. This is. I never knew there was this much in this story. I have to tell you.
And then
I started digging around. I'm saying, boy, that's a lot of stuff in this story.
Yeah,
this
it's just like
really,
I'm a little. I was a little reluctant to leave the story of Moshe because all of what follows as Moshe is going to Arabia and becoming a shepherd, and him interacting with the seven daughters and the priest's name and what the entire conversation and the words that were chosen. There is a profound lesson in every one of those scenes, and you just—it's hard not to want to share it. But that's really the nature of God. So we don't happen to know if Cain brought apples or turnips. We don't know if he brought lemons or mushrooms. He may have been offering Brussels sprouts for all we know—the worst or the best of his harvest, something delectable or rotten. He may have even been mocking Yahweh, trying to mimic the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of lives. However, with Hebel, we know that he offered the firstborn and best of his flock, his fittest, his finest. So Yahweh's reaction may have been as much about attitude as it was about substance. And this is an essential insight. You know, we're a couple of weeks from being able to celebrate Passover. And as most years, there's you can celebrate it one day versus the next, and there's very little overall difference as to, are we better on one day or another? You know, for example, I think we're going to celebrate it on the beginning of the natural Shabbat, and therefore on the 26th as the sun goes down. That's actually next Friday. But we could begin it on the 27th. And the message there is it's not about the substance of the timing and what you do. It's far more about your attitude. Are you really celebrating the doorway to life? Are you celebrating Yahweh's provision? Are you spending time celebrating the relationship? You know, it's about our attitude far more than the substance of what's on our plate or the substance of what day we do this. And the same thing is true with what happened here. So speaking of substance, I had really hoped that I was going to be able to finish questioning Paul and be able to start in volume one and to have been able to have edited the Passover story and then matzah and B'Kodem before this year. And that's part of that's true. I did finish the fourth volume of Questioning Paul. So it's in its final edit stage. The other three volumes are now available at Amazon for purchase. No royalty, as you know. And I'm within a day probably of finishing the first chapter of volume four, which leads to Passover, because I'm telling the story of Moshe and how Moshe became Yahweh's implement to lead the chosen people out of Mitzrayim, which is what leads us to Passover. So there is you don't actually start with Passover. If you're going to tell the story of Passover, you have to start well before Passover, and the story begins with Moshe. So, unfortunately, I'll have one chapter available, but it's a precursor to Pesach.net. Mm-hmm. Well, making good progress.
I was just going to say I'm glad that you mentioned that about the dates, because there's the observable, which is the Saturday. And the reason, only reason I was doing it on the Saturday, because in order to participate in the show and then still be able to take some stuff to Terry would be difficult on Friday night. So I'm going to share
and
that
that's,
with
and that's
Saturday.
Kind of what I was thinking, too. Yeah, because even for me, the Friday night is now 7:30. It used to be at 8:30 because we don't do daylight savings time here, and the show is is set for, I think, a central time, which they do is daylight saving. Mm-hmm. So now at 7:30, it would be very difficult for us to do PSOC at the right time as the sun is setting, and then transition immediately to the show. So we may also do it on the Shabbat, just because it becomes more relaxed, a bigger celebration if we do it on the either way, it's on a Shabbat,
like
right?
Absolutely. And what I like to do, I know it's symbolic, but for instance, after we eat some of the lamb, I like to burn up. I like to keep the fire going and burn it up, and I can't be in two places and watch fire. So I was like, how am I going to do this and still? And I do like, I know I know you don't have to do this. This is symbolic. It's better to understand. I could be in, if they stuck me in prison, I can still celebrate Passover by understanding.
Yeah.
You know, so it wouldn't, it's not that, but I enjoy all those things symbolically. So.
And we have to decide this year, do we encourage some of our friends to enjoy Pesach with us that have learned recently that they are Jewish, that didn't even know it. So we may do that as well. So but again, we have that flexibility because God was not specific on the timing, because he did not say this much of the moon has to be visible at this time before or after the sun sets. For you to determine whether or not that is the beginning of the month of Abib, nor did he say that Abib could be calibrated as the first light on the moon closest to the vernal equinox. You know, if you think about the first grain crop, and it has to be Abib, which means it's the grain is present in the kernel, but still green and growing, which is very symbolic and meaningful, flexible, if you will, green and growing, pliable, that it would be Abib. So it's the renewed light on the moon closest to the time that a barley crop would be green and growing in the kernel. And that just happens to be right around the vernal equinox. So as we look at it this year, the high likelihood is that you can either be Friday night or Saturday night. And because there is that flexibility, and I think if we were to do it straight up, I'd make the decision for Friday night. But I also realize, just as in this story of Cain and Hebel, it's the attitude that makes the difference. And if by doing this program effectively next week, we postpone our Pesach meal to Saturday, just like you, we can spend much longer time celebrating it. And it's my favorite night of the year.
We don't like to be rushed either.
Well, no. You know, he doesn't want to be shortchanged. You know, he doesn't. You know, he likes to party. And, you know, listen, if he was willing to be patient for 3,500 years, I'm convinced, and, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way it came across to me this morning. As I was writing the insights that were derived from that story of how the Hebrews responded to Moshe and what Moshe had done for them, that when you realize that Moshe represents Yahweh and the Israelites, those Hebrews represent the Israelites for thousands of years, you know, God could not have been in much of a hurry if he put that story in, not expecting someone to share its meaning with his people for 3,500 years. So I think you're correct. He's not in a hurry. Fair enough.
Fair enough.
All right. So it is about attitudes. Not only do sheep equate to the Lamb of God, the Pesach Gael, sheep are endearing. And the sheep, the relationship with the shepherd is endearing. Sheep are not only a source of protein. Their wool is used to make clothing. Their hides will make a shelter. You know, one thing that was interesting with Leah, she's just this, you know, the sweetest, kindest person in the world. And just that whole idea of even me killing a spider or, you know, a mouse that has gone into the house, you know, she can't handle it. But, you know, it's something she can't do, but she's raised sheep. And she realized that you raise sheep to eat them. And absolutely, as a shepherd, understood that and was nurtured by them and yet loved them. So it's a, you know, it is a whole different attitude, that of a shepherd. You know, sometimes prophecy is really subtle, Kirk, a little more than a foreshadowing of things to come. And here is Yahweh is revealing his preference for a perfect firstborn lamb to be the acceptable means to resolve the issues which separate us from him. The unblemished sacrificial lamb represents Yahusha and his willingness to resolve the consequence of our rebellion, opening the doorway to life on Passover. So, more simply stated, Yahweh wants us to understand the purpose and benefits of Pesach. You know, the door had been closed to the garden, but it was open now to his home, via Pesach. This is a particular concern to rabbinic and Orthodox Jews who attend Pesach without an appropriate portion of lamb. Given enough time, if any, a lamb bone.
It's the bone, isn't it?
Going to, yes. Yep, but they've got something. They've got, you know, 12 other things on the plate that they've got a rabbinic explanation for. Given enough time, we will all disappoint Yahweh in some way.
True.
When this occurs, we simply learn from the mistake and go past us. Throwing a tizzy fit is really a poor life choice. Cain had become what his mother envisioned. As a result of his animus and his resentment, we're told that Cain's appearance was Nabal, downcast, as if experiencing an act of prostration or abortion, a miscarriage, and his presence had become overtly hostile and unappealing.
And that's a pretty good explanation, but I got some more. You want to hear some more?
Sure.
Okay. Nabal, of course, is the verb. It is it is all of those things. It's crestfallen. It's to be to rebel. It's an apostate. And this is the verb for the word Nephalim. Now, you have to remember where Nephalim, where we first heard that. Remember, J.B. did that whole rebuttal to the giants of, in the book of Enoch. And they were called Nephilim or Nephalim, however you pronounce it. And that word actually doesn't mean giant. It means bully, tyrant, especially violent, one who ruins things, things that perish, they kill things just for fun, and they're in a calamitous and cause calamities. And then I was looking through Nephal and the verb and then Nephilim as the noun. I went to the root, which is a pelem, of that word, and it means to fall or plead, perform, dark, to bow down in submission, to speak to an authority, and that comes back to another word when you're tracking it on your search engines through a lexicon. I get, it goes from there, and then it says, now look at Palal. So I looked up Palal, and I've always told people this is bowing down. It is not prayer. And that's the, so Palal comes from the same root, I mean, from the same association. It means to cast down, to fall down, to die, to smite, to perish. And yet they always translate that as something, they translate that as prayer. So if you like connecting the dots,
Mm-hmm.
That's a word. It's fun. And of course, prayer of Palal is a P-double-L. But that's
a very religious word, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a religious word. It's a violent word. A downcast word. Yes. It's all the things that God wouldn't want. And people bowing down as opposed to standing up.
Yeah. So to me, that when you say something like that about Cain, boy, he didn't just, man, she.
Yeah.
This is really bad.
He did not earn Yahweh's favor, that's for sure.
No.
So Yahweh said to Cain, "For what reason have you kindled such animosity and become so enraged? And why is your presence in the fall, downcast, fallen, such that you are out of control over the situation, as if experiencing an act of prostration or an abortion, even a miscarriage?" God's asked some really probing questions. So if you're going to church and you're bowing down, how would you square that with God said, "What's wrong with you? Why are you bowing down?" If you're angry at God because, you're somebody you loved died, and you're angry at God saying, "Why did you take them?" That had nothing to do with things. But if you're angry at God, that's a really bad idea. God is asking Canis, "Why are you so angry? Just because I preferred his way over your way?" Yeah. Newsflash.
Why don't you learn from that?
If God prefers lamb over Brussels sprouts, come to the party with a lamb. I mean, this isn't all that hard. That's all Cain would have had to say is, "Okay, my bad. Don't like Brussels sprouts. I don't much like them either."
Okay.
I want to read you. Good to know. Next year, I'll come with a really pretty lamb. That's it. It's not hard.
I like your best line here.
Yeah, God is making it really clear what he does not like. He does not like when we kindle animosity against him. Every religion kindles animosity against God. You know who the person that hated God more than anybody probably who's ever lived? Paul. The man wrote and inspired two-thirds of the Christian New Testament. Paul.
You got to have a real hate on to do what he did.
Ooh.
I mean, and you never quit.
Yeah, I mean, when you call God's testimony pornography. When you cast God as the cruel taskmaster, as opposed to cast God in the role of Moses trying to free his people, to advise his people, to liberate his people, to protect his people. No, rather than casting God in the role of Moshe as the liberator, no, Paul cast God in the role of the Egyptian taskmaster. So, you've got a pretty good hatred going God at that point.
That always reminds me, Dode wrote the 89th Psalm, and it starts out with about mercy. Paul came, there's no mercy there. He's a horrible taskmaster.
Correct.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, the 89th Psalm in its entirety made it into Volume 4 of Questioning Paul.
Oh, did? Good.
Oh, yes.
That's one of my favorites. Yeah.
Yep. The best advice is to figure out what pleases God and embrace it. Now, you don't need to do that. God's really fair about this. You do not need to please God. You don't need to learn about him. You don't need to do diddly squat. So you got a bunch of choices. One choice is you can completely ignore him. Welcome to the world of socialist secular humanism. You can choose to worship a false god. Welcome to the world of Christianity and Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Hinduism. You can choose to be
thousands of them
among those who lead people away from God. Welcome to the world of academia and of religious theologians and clerics and pastors and priests. You can choose to contradict God, as did Paul. Akiba, Maimonides. You can choose to believe in conspiracies and ultimately turn against God's people. You've got all sorts of opportunities, or you can actually pay attention to what God said, come to understand what he's offering, accept it, and figure out what he wants in return and act upon that. You've got all those choices. We can do whatever one you want. But I can tell you, it only turns out well for those who actually consider what God wants and respond accordingly. It is his home. Mm-hmm. It's his universe. It is his home. Life is his invention. And if you want yours extended such that you live with him in his home, then pay attention to what he likes. Pay attention to what he's offering and asking in return. It isn't difficult. If you don't care, then just go away. Go bother somebody else. The converse is also useful. Figure out what God does not like and avoid it. Well, God does not like people who hold animosity towards him. He doesn't like people who are downcast, who are aggressive, violent, who are bowing down. Doesn't like that either. It is often asked, how did Abel know to bring a lamb? I think the answer is he didn't. He was a shepherd, so he brought what he loved.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
And that is the underlying message of the whole thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We cannot truly love fruit, but sheep are genuinely adoring. Shepherds develop a mutually beneficial relationship with their flock. So it's not a matter of what Hebel may have known, but instead it is Yahweh's response which matters. He preferred Hebel's approach, thereby encouraging us to respond in kind. Don't share the worst of what you have, but the best. It was a Torah teaching moment, which is lost on most. This brings us to an interesting point. Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Share what you love. Now,
well, it's a Torah means teaching.
Esau.
This is all what this is about. Yeah.
Because you want to be there, because you enjoy Yahweh's company. Bring your A game, your best personality. Now, this brings us to an interesting point. The Torah and the prophets present the lives of mostly ordinary people, whose stories are told warts and all. As such, there are countless bad examples we can learn from, but should never emulate their behavior. Now, as I'm studying right now Moshe, Moshe showed character. He had backbone. You know, mm-hmm. I understand that Moshe, when God says, I want you to go back and liberate my people, he said, no, you got the wrong guy.
Been there, done that.
Been there, done that. I'm not going back there. And I'm going to share a thought with you here in a moment on that. But I was wrong about Moshe. Moshe's risked everything to intervene to protect one of his brothers from a man with a weapon who was beating him to death. That showed fortitude. It showed character. It showed compassion. It showed the kind of resolve that Yahweh adores. And then when he was out there in Arabia and he saw these women come to the well, and the shepherds violently, aggressively kicked him out. They said, your sheep can't drink. You can't be here. And they were aggressive with him. And Moshe said, no. It's not going to work. Stood up on behalf of these women. Stood up on behalf of their flock. He intervened. He showed character, fortitude, backbone. It even says that he took a stand. Yahweh likes that. When we are willing to take a stand, we're willing to be accounted. And, Dode was the epitome of this. So it is a trait that Yahweh clearly respects. So there's another Torah teaching moment that is
mm-hmm.
lost on most. But there are absolutely a number of bad examples of people not to emulate. Cain did not have a good answer for Yahweh. His silence regarding Yahweh's question spoke volumes in its own right. You know, if God asks me a question, and it could be a question just like this, where he's asking Cain a question, as far as I'm concerned, he didn't incorporate that question in his Torah to facilitate an answer from Cain. He gave this information to Moshe a very long time after Cain was long gone.
Yes.
So that question is there for you and me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's our responsibility, if we care about Yahweh, to answer the daggone question. And, you know, Cain didn't have a good answer. I hope we do. I hope ours is more thoughtful. Sensing an opportunity to teach, God addressed Cain's depressing and condescending attitude. I've shared many times on this program that there's only one disability that is crippling. You can overcome being blind. You can overcome being deaf. You can overcome being crippled. You can overcome OCD and most every other psychological and mental and physical limitation and challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't overcome a bad attitude.
No.
It's debilitating. I remember one time in my life I had one. My attitude is usually something that's pretty upbeat and positive. I mostly see the world as filled with opportunities each day as a wonderful opportunity to make a difference, and so I'm exceedingly positive. I have essentially no fear. Love Yahweh, love what we're doing here. My attitude is usually pretty darn good, but I remember a time when I went through about a month of my life where I was really depressed a long, long time ago. And I had good reason to be depressed, but I was depressed. And I remember just how hopeless and empty and hollow that made me. And it wasn't really until I got out of myself and said, you know, I need to move on. I need to start doing something that's worthwhile. You need to make a contribution. And once you are gainfully productively involved, it goes all away. But a bad attitude is a very debilitating thing. And I don't like the Pollyanna happy. I think...
No, you can't put this in something fake.
No, it's got to be real. Don't blow smoke. It's got to be real. But in this relationship with Yahweh, we get such confidence. We have such rewards. We have such liberty. We have such enlightenment that there's a lot of reasons to have a positive, upbeat, confident attitude. So God decided that he was going to deal with this depressing and condescending attitude. He did not issue a commandment, nor did he seek to be obeyed. He didn't solicit faith. Nor did he tell Cain what to do. Instead, Yahweh offered one of life's greatest lessons. He said, in essence, that a good attitude is among our most endearing and enabling attributes, while an unappealing disposition is our most alienating and crippling. You know, for those that are lonely and can't find a mate, maybe it's your attitude. If you act appropriately and are pleasant to be around, you'll find forgiveness and acceptance. If, to the contrary, based upon the proposition, you act appropriately and are pleasant to be around, yatab, you are consistently cheerful and happy, doing what is expected and right, and you are pleasing and joyful, reasonable to deal with, hifl and perfect. You'll find forgiveness and acceptance, Shia. Your situation will improve dramatically because you will be lifted up, supported, sustained. You will ascend, rising in status and honor, be exonerated, experiencing an increase in dignity, brilliance, esteem, and illustriousness. If only you have a positive attitude, you'll find forgiveness and acceptance. If you act inappropriately and are miserable to be around, the negation of Yathav, you aren't pleasant, pleasing, or joyful, you continue to be wrong and hard to deal with, then the sin of being wrong and going astray is crouching in the doorway. Well, the doorway is the doorway to life. It's the entrance to Yahweh's home. This is Pesach. And so one brought the Pesach lamb. The other was so full of himself and so miserable to be around, then the offense was just crouching right in the doorway. So
I think he knew it.
I think
he knew this, and he insulted Yahweh. Digging up comes to prove that up somewhere in here. Had all that
he
stuff
could,
in his
yeah. He couldn't get out of his own way, Kirk. That's just
he couldn't get out of his own way.
You know, when that month of my life when I was depressed, I couldn't get out of my own way. That's what he's saying here. If you're depressed, you can't get out of your own way. You can't get out of your own head. How are you going to have a positive, meaningful, uplifting, mutually enjoyable relationship if you can't get out of your own head? We have a friend that came over today. Wonderful, wonderful young lady. She is a survivor, coming out of a very difficult situation, a wonderful mother, just a terrific friend. A real delight to be around, and occasionally she has to battle with what she endured as a child. Religion really, really screwed her up, and so when she suffers from that, my advice is always the same: get out of your own head. You have this marvelous, beautiful, sensitive, artistic daughter, and you've done such a wonderful job of raising her. You have such wonderful friends. You have such a positive job, making such a difference. You have such a clear mind, such wonderful opportunities. Just go off and do something positive. Make a contribution. Get out of your own head for a moment. If you stay in your own head, it'll just sweep you right back down to where you were, not where you come. And that's really the truth for everyone. Is, you know, I wake up in the morning and I can't wait to come into my study and open the books and begin to translate and write, because I anticipate that we're going to find something like this morning. And, you know, when I shared that this morning, I don't know if it resonated the same degree that it did for me and Leah when I shared it with her, but I was in tears when I read it the second time through. Could hardly read it. I got so choked up, and to have that level of communication with Yahweh, a moment like that is what I anticipate. Oh, what Dode said, he got up early in the morning, couldn't wait to begin, so that he was prepared and ready to go. No, that's good advice for all of us. So if you act appropriately or pleasant to be around, you'll find forgiveness and acceptance. And if you act inappropriately and are miserable to be around, then the sin of being wrong and of going astray is crouching in the doorway, which is to say you won't be able to get out of your own way. You're going to trip over yourself. You can't find a doorway to life because you're blocking the way.
But think of Yahweh's perspective, too. He don't want you to come in and do that for eternity.
No, but he's at least merciful and compassionate enough to say, you know, if you get out of your own way, then this opportunity is there for you.
Yeah.
But you've got to get out of your own way first.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you are, I love it when God just clarifies something. So sometimes, you know, we're just reading something and it seems so obvious this is what God is saying. And then he says what we've been saying. And then you feel like, well, that was, why did I go to all that trouble to add this commentary
when he said it all by himself.
When he said it already. But you know, that's okay because it means that our understanding, our thought process is consistent with Yahweh's. When it's consistent with Yahweh's, then we're doing as well as we can do. So if you're too into yourself, you are too into yourself. These intense desires and impulses, the overwhelming urge for dominance, and this yearning for salvation are things that you must learn to better explain and govern. By Rashid in the beginning, Genesis 4:7. You're just too into yourself. That's the religious thing, you know, for Christians. You want to be saved, or if it's Islam, Allah is going to send you to hell. You know, it's overwhelming desire for salvation. It's so enormously selfish. Let's just be honest about it. Seeking to be saved is selfish. Seeking to engage in a relationship is mutually satisfying and beneficial. And learn what Yahweh is offering in terms of relationship. Engage in the relationship. Make a contribution to the relationship. And oh, by the way, salvation will be a byproduct of that. You don't have to ask for it. You don't have to seek it. But if you are seeking it, you're going about it wrong. If you're seeking it, you're being selfish. You're way too into yourself. And that doesn't work in a relationship. Now, there's a Torah teaching moment. Stop trying to be saved. Instead, try to engage in the relationship in a meaningful way so that you're making a contribution. You know, I felt this morning.
You said that 15 years ago.
That was it. I was making a contribution. I felt satisfied, uplifted, nourished, whole, appreciated. It was wonderful. Because you're thinking, you know, when this is shared with God's people, it will help them understand where they have been all of these years, why the world is as it is. It's a marvelous thing. It's a reassuring thing. It's a nurturing thing. It's an uplifting thing. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted you, Kirk.
No, I just said you had said that about salvation. You have to remember, I have to remember sometimes how many shows I've gotten to be on with you. And it's almost 13 years now, if not more. But it's you've been saying that the whole time. This Christian thing about salvation leads their parade.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Yeah, and Islam
if I come in your house and I'm your family, adopted in your family, I ain't worried about being saved. I'm part of your family. What am I looking for? I've already got it.
Yeah. Even if the child in a family, say if the child's in harm's way, and they say, "Daddy, save me," there or "Mommy, save me," they're not asking for eternal salvation. What they're asking is deliverance from harm's way. Get me out of this mess.
Yeah.
Liberate me from this problem. It saved me from harm. And that's what they mean by the term. It's what the Hebrew word yatsa means anyway, and yasha.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a really crappy attitude. We are way too into ourselves when we're seeking salvation. You know, when the Christian evangelist says, "Are you saved?" Or the Catholic priest, you know, does the last rites or the confession so that you can be saved, it's stunningly selfish. And you're offering nothing to Yahweh. You're not even making an attempt to know who he is. You're asking God to save you before you even bother to listen to what he has to say or even
what that implies.
Well, what it would mean. So it's not just that seeking to be saved is wrong. It's exceedingly selfish. That's what God's saying here. Get out of yourself. You're way too into yourself. Your intense desires and impulses, the overwhelming urge for dominance and yearning for salvation are things you must learn to better govern. There, you are out of control. Yahweh's advice to Cain was mostly attitudinal, but also relational. Life is a learning experience, and thus he wanted Cain to know what a person would do to, should do to be wise, and that was to control their impulses. Empathy, because he was being narcissistic, would also be advised. You know, a narcissist has an empathy disorder. There may even, and I think that Cain was a narcissist. There may even be a bit of Jewish history playing out here beneath these words. Historically, conquest has been esteemed over the ability to communicate effectively. We know the names of pharaohs, the kings, the generals, not a result of their words, but because of their armies and that they prevailed. Can you quote a speech from Alexander the so-called Great?
Not really, but
and
I know
you,
about him.
You know about the battles that he won. How about Julius Caesar?
Oh, of course.
We know of Julius Caesar because, well, he prevailed in Gaul, and then prevailed against. The triumphant of other rivals.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
We know what they did.
Right. We know what they did. We don't know what
they
said.
Certainly.
Right.
No, they didn't say much.
You know, right. We don't know what Hadrian said. We know what Hadrian did. So, and that's typically the thing, that people become known because of the battles they won. We don't really ever contemplate what Genghis Khan or Kublai Khan or Tamerlane said. They're known because their armies prevailed in battle. In today's culture, the skill needed to win, prevailing over others, is valued over self-control. Political candidates who fail are quickly forgotten as athletes without trophies. All too often, might makes right and brutes prevail. It's very seldom that somebody becomes known for enlightening words, for being willing to speak the truth, to share the truth. Yahweh was encouraging Cain to think before emoting and to speak out before acting out. There is an enduring, liberating, and uplifting legacy of a well-spoken word that is individually and collectively transformative, while an angry fist hurts everyone. With infinitely more power than exists in the entire universe, words have always been Yahweh's preferred implements. They're good enough for God. Don't you think they're good enough for us?
Yes.
Didn't he use words to talk the universe into existence? Didn't he use words?
He spoke it into existence.
Develop a relationship with us, to teach us, to guide us, to make promises
Gave
to us.
This.
Yes. If words are good enough for Yahweh, chances are they're good enough for us too. If we want to join Yahweh, wield words wisely. There is an aspect of Teshkukah that I found interesting in the previous statement. It's I wrote a lot about Teshkukah. Let me share it again. It's these intense desires and impulses, the overwhelming urge for dominance and yearning for salvation, this uncontrollable emotional response, these strong feelings and cravings, need to win and the passion for conquest, Eshuka, are things you need to get under control, that you need to be able to explain and to govern. So there is an aspect of that word that I found sufficiently intriguing to incorporate it into the translation. It is apparent that Cain had brought his ill-advised offering in hopes of finding salvation. And that was something Yahweh thought to rebuke. In so doing, he was undermining the raison d'etre of religion. You won't find salvation in donations.
But one and, place, yeah.
Yeah, in church participation and and anything of that nature. In particular, Christianity and Islam prevail because they offer the false hope of salvation to those who are afraid of death and fearful of what the afterlife might entail. I mean, I can see if you're a Muslim why you would be afraid of such things, because Allah is spending all of his time in hell, torturing people. And yet a God who would save those who do not listen to him, who do not know him, who do not appreciate what he is offering or asking in return, who believe in all manner of deceptions regarding him, would be irrelevant. He'd be foolish. Let's imagine. It's true. A God who would save those who do not know him, who have no idea what he's asking or offering, who have chosen to believe wild-ass deceptions regarding him, a God who would do so would be irrelevant, be foolish. Worse, a God who would carefully articulate and then meticulously affect the means to spend eternity with him, who would then save those who completely disregard his approach in preference of one which is religious, would be dishonest and untrustworthy. Do you want to spend eternity with a God like that?
No.
Yeah, a God like that would be very capable of making eternity eternal torture.
Yeah, no question.
You know, we ought not seek salvation. Strive to know Yahweh. Then if you like and respect him, devote the time to understand what he is asking of us and offering in return. If you do, what you'll discover is that Yahweh is offering to perfect us, to make us immortal, to adopt us into his family, and then enrich and empower us. A funny thing. Salvation is not listed among these benefits. It is only a byproduct of them. And even then, it's a function from being liberated from harm's way, from being freed from human, political, and religious constraints. And that's why the Hebrew word that is the only Hebrew word that can really be translated save, salvation, savior, is yasha. And yet, that's not what the word actually means. It means to liberate, to free,
set free,
to deliver from harm's way. It's only to say it in the sense of saving
very concrete terms, isn't it?
Yeah, from a danger. It is a very concrete term. It and the term is first used in the context of Yahweh working with Moshe and liberating the children of Israel from the crucibles of human, religious, and political oppression in such a way that it can only be translated to deliver. It was the seven women that he met at the well. He delivered them from the harmful influence of the rival shepherds. He didn't save them in the sense of an eternal reward. There was no religious conversion. There was no promise of eternal life in heaven. It wasn't saving them. Yasha was
the situation.
Used to say, I removed you from harm's way.
Right.
I delivered you from harm's way. I I liberated you from these hurtful and oppressive, violent men. And it's that, I think, is resonates throughout this whole story of what went wrong with Cain. He was seeking to be saved, doing something his way, half-heartedly, you know, as if it's all you have to do is believe, as if your opinion was you had the right to your opinion, and it came with a crappy attitude, and God said, no, I'm not buying it. You're way too into yourself. You came here to be saved. You're acting religious. You're downcast. No, this does not appeal to me. He offered me Brussels sprouts, for crying out loud. I don't even like Brussels sprouts. God is trying to drive home an essential message. If we're too into ourselves, if we're seeking to be saved, then we aren't making a contribution to the relationship. And under that circumstance, there's no reason whatsoever for God to grant us eternal life in his home in heaven. Such a person would be miserable to be around. That's the nature of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kirk, I want to switch gears, and we'll obviously speak about Pesach, maybe a little bit about Lot and Hakodim next week. On our program. I won't be there in terms of rewriting that chapter. I apologize. It's got a lot of old and dated material in it. We're getting to it. I think we have 15 books now completed, 15 different volumes.
Wow.
So we're a little more than halfway there. I will say that the process now is much slower. So as we've moved into what will be two volumes of the invitations, the Mikra. One's called Mikra, the other one called Moed. I'm probably slowed now to a maximum of about 15 pages a day because I have not done those translations in 10, 12 years. So it's not just a matter of removing the stuff that was wrong that we've learned differently. It's about retranslating each of the passages, and when you do that, you end up ignoring most of the commentary that you wrote, and writing what is what you're inspired to see based upon the newer translation. So it is a lot more uplifting. It's a lot more enjoyable. I think it's going to be more beneficial to the family, for the family. But it's a slow process. So. I promise we'll be through with it by next Passover, but we'll not be through with it by this Passover. Hopefully, in fact, I think it's a pretty good chance that by Shavuot we'll be concurrent with Shavuot. We'll be long before Kippurim and Sukkah. We'll have volumes 4 and 5 of Yada Yahwa completed. And so we are making progress. It's fun. We got a great team that is committed to it. The books look great. They're so much easier to read, so much more credible, and so much more accurate that it is worth the effort. I'm one of the things I'm really looking forward to doing. I keep it up all the time because I put it into the new format, knowing that it's got to be something I do soon. Is the 119th Psalm. So that'll be something. We'll create a new translation and go through that as well. So there's a lot to do. We'll return to Pesach next week, maybe through the preamble of the story as it's told through Moses, during the time that he is really being prepared to be the great liberator. Then the story within the story. As we go along. So may Yah bless. I look forward to being with you at Pesach this time next week. Blessed to you, Kirk, and the entire family.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good night.